Welcome to the Angry Admin Podcast for July 2nd, 2007, episode 33. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Angry Admins Podcast. My name is Joe Bibby.
Hey folks, I'm Ryan Necessary.
This week on the show, we have some exciting tech news. We're going to talk about what we think the future holds for web apps, and Ryan is going to give us an overview of some great FTP clients. All right, to start things off with the news this week, we are going to cover the story we avoided last week. The iPhone came out last Friday, and part of the reason we've decided to cover this story is, one, it's just a big story, but two, apparently it's already been hacked. The iPhone root password has been cracked, which apparently doesn't get you much yet, but the firmware also has been released on the internets, on the tubes, and so I look forward to some hacking of the iPhone. Though I have a feeling they will not be as friendly towards it as they are on the Apple TV.
Right.
Because it is on this gigantic Singular network, and Singular probably won't be happy about it. So, but either way, the iPhone, very cool device. I actually was able to get my hands on one at the Apple Store here in town. And in general, I would say I'm 98% impressed.
Good.
Which is a good thing. I mean, you know, I went in, I tried to go in without any... Steve Jobs blinders and you know, kind of low expectations, and it really delivered everything it promised. You know, the keyboard takes a little getting used to. Mm-hmm. I only spent about 15 minutes on one, but I was able to start thumb typing by the end. I'm disappointed that the only software expansion is through the through Safari, through the web browser. Though I am hopeful that they will maybe within a year start letting people develop for it. Either way, very cool device. Definitely sets a new high standard for cell phones. My favorite thing is that you can activate your account through iTunes at home without having to talk to anybody. You can just go to the App Store, buy a phone, take it home.
Right.
Pick your plan. You're done.
So one thing I heard him talking about was if you buy it at the AT&T locations, that not only will they not have as many, they may not have the model you want because they tend to sell out of the biggest ones fastest at the AT&T stores. Also, if you buy it at an AT&T store, you're locked to going back to AT&T for 14 days for any problems that you have. So you can't buy it from AT&T, take it home, have a problem, and then run to the Apple store for support, because they say, we'll come back in 14 days. You're stuck with AT&T.
Wow. So there's some motivation not to go to AT&T.
Yeah.
And there's really no need to get it from AT&T. So if you have... I guess if you don't have an Apple store, which we are pretty fortunate to have that, but if you're in a smaller town, you probably don't have one.
And they also said that they were selling iTunes at like $150 an hour at Apple stores and like $15 an hour at the AT&T stores.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so they were definitely less efficient. Right. They were doing some cool things in the lines, too. Like at the Apple stores, they were handing out water and Gatorade and like snacks. They were treating them pretty well, so that they really had it figured out and planned out, very detailed, as always.
Yeah, seemed to be good.
Yeah, I mean, overall, the reviews have been good, positive, mostly positive. There were a few negative things. The Edge network has been slow and spotty. Apparently, AT&T wasn't ready for all the usage, and it's been crashing. And,
wow.
But there have been rumors that the speeds are significantly better than previous Edge speeds. Even as of last week, the speeds are better. So
that's cool.
We'll see how things pan out over the long haul. But either way, that's enough iPhone news for us, I think.
Yes. We're not going to flood you, because if you follow tech at all, then you're already sick of iPhone
stuff.
So. Moving on to other things. So in the Netherlands, there's a university where they're working on improving hard disk drive speeds. And their goal is to do this via lasers. So they're talking about up to 100 times faster than current hard drive access speeds.
So we're going to have hard drives with frickin' laser beams?
Yes, laser beams on the shark's head.
Nice. Sorry.
In 12 12 hours, I will destroy Washington, D.C. with this giant laser.
So, yeah, they're working on that. Right now they said the holdup is the, I guess, the footprint of the laser itself. Mm-hmm. They need to get that down smaller before it's going to be a viable thing. And the article that was linked off of Engadget wasn't exactly sure how they were achieving the read-write access.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, still interesting to see that one day we might have speed of light data transfer.
Well, that'd be nice.
Now, the only thing that I wonder about, though, is the real bottleneck with hard drive access the read-write part of it, or is it the actual spinning of the hard drive part of it?
Seems like the spin-up is really what ends up slowing you down. I mean, they've done enough with caching and all kinds of things to be able to increase the speeds of those hard drives.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll keep an eye on it, but that is interesting because you don't have that much hard drive technology news that comes out. So.
Well, and it is kind of the final bottleneck. I mean, hard drives are pretty much the slowest things in your machine now. So,
if you remember right, too, back in our New Year's program, you know, many months ago, when we were making predictions for this year, I was thinking that we would have the hybrid hard drives probably on the shelf by now, but I don't see any.
I haven't seen any. You probably can order them online, but they're definitely not in stores.
Kind of scary.
Yeah. So, well, and those haven't really been proven to be that much better from what I've seen. Well, I guess I'm thinking of the stupid USB key thing on Vista. That's totally different. So
right.
Ignore that statement.
Ready
Strike
boost.
That from the record.
Yeah.
Edit that out. Oh. Okay. So another IT story. Fast TCP has been commercialized into an FTP appliance. So a little backstory, TCP is, you know, one of the old internet technologies, you know, designed really for slow speeds, 300 BPS modems, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's starting to show its age in that it's not able to keep up with the flood of traffic from, you know, gigantic backhauls and that kind of thing. So there's been a lot of research in improving the algorithm for TCP to allow it to, if the pipes are clogged, do a better job of keeping up with that.
Mm-hmm.
FastTP is one of those options. The unfortunate thing about FastTCP is it's designed to be commercialized from the outset. So it's not designed to be an open standard, which I think both of us kind of frown on that when it comes to a base technology like this.
So is this going to be a thing where, like, people pretty much, it's kind of like a toll road, like, hey, if you want to go fast, come to us.
So that's what's great about this commercialization of it. They've built this FTP appliance that only requires the appliance to know about fast TCP. So you can plug this into a network and get, according to the company, which the creators of fast TCP also created this product. So we'll see when we see independent testing. But they're claiming 15 to 20 times faster FTP transmissions from this device, which is all it does is FTP.
So it's like a magic box. I have one, right. You have one, and if that's the case, then we...
No, only one of you needs one. So you throw it on your network...
I got you.
And somebody's on their computer, they download something from this FTP server, it's 15 to 20 times faster.
That's nice.
Or you plug it into the internet as an FTP server for sending out code or, you know, lots of other resources that FTP is used for.
Mm-hmm. And FTP, really, really you feel it, especially at work when you're trying to get something big or what are you sending or receiving.
Right.
You feel how slow it is now.
Yes, exactly. So... according to the report, it supports, you know, a gigabit link up to and all the way down to just standard 10 megabit links and still will increase your speed because of the way it caches the TCP. Overall, very cool device. So I'm excited to see something like this come down the pipe.
That is nice. Okay, on the Google Home front, there's a new thing this week, a new feature in Google Maps. As you know, you can basically plan out a route and draw the route on the Google Map. And on the left side of the screen, it will show you, you know, turn right here, turn left there, whatever. So now they've added a new thing sort of with the application. So if you decide to change your route, you can just, the blue line that connects your destination and your start point,
right?
You can just grab that line and pull it and change your route.
Okay, see, that's totally sweet.
It is nice.
Because that has been one of the more frustrating things about Google Maps.
Mm-hmm. So say I'm going to my parents, which is 5 hours away. I have my route planned, and I'm looking at Google Maps, and suddenly my sister calls and says, oh, they shut down Highway 45.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, what am I going to do? Well, I can just go into Google Maps and just grab that line and just pull it to the left or the right, and it's just dynamically creating other routes for me.
That's nice.
Not only that, but also on the left side, it's updating your list of turn here, turn here,
Very cool.
So, and it's lightning fast. I mean, it's like real time as you track it.
See, that's one of the things that it just never really worked for me. I guess you could do this on like the desktop apps, mm-hmm. but I'm always too cheap to pay for those because I know I can get it for free. But if I wanted, you know, say I wanted to take a like 4-hour trip to somewhere, but I wanted to go along the coastline, even though it takes an extra 2 hours.
Right.
With this, I can just drag it down and tell it this is the way I want
to
go.
Right. So in theory, if you wanted to go to the most scenic route,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could, in this top-down view, you could just keep dragging up next to the beach.
Right.
And it would tell you this would take forever, but at least you would have the most scenic route possible.
That's very nice.
So thanks, guys at Google. That's a nice update to Google Maps.
That is a very nice update. The only unfortunate thing about Google Maps is that it is always online. But maybe in the future, though, we'll tie that into some of their offline services. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But if you are requiring online and you're an AT&T customer, AT&T announced a new thing this week that if you are part of their pro or higher DSL service, you automatically get free access to all of their public access points that previously you would have had to pay for to use.
Mm. Do we think there's a lot of those?
Every single McDonald's.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
So that's a lot.
I guess it's been forever since I've been inside of a McDonald's.
Right.
But it has not been very long since McDonald's was inside of me.
tasty dinner. So this is good news for me because I am a pro DSL user. So the pro level is their 3 megabit speed, and then they have one more above that called Elite, mm-hmm. which I'm too cheap to pay for. So this is pretty cool for me because this is all the McDonald's, all the Barnes & Noble's bookstores, and then there's like several other places that have this. And I'll be able to just go in there, use my DSL account. So it's the sbcglobal.net. email address that I created when I set up my DSL.
That's pretty cool.
I have to find that password again, though.
Mm.
I don't ever use it.
Does Barnes & Noble have a thing where you, like, buy books and you pick them up at the store?
Don't know. Probably. We'll go with yes.
For the purpose of this conversation, sure, they do, right? So I'm just saying, like, you could drift into Starbucks, flip open your Mac,
mm-hmm.
shop for books on the Barnes & Noble site, tell it you wanted to pick it up, and then as you're finishing your coffee, you throw your cup away, you walk up to the counter and says, I'm here to pick up my order that I made from like right over there. Now they went and found all the books for you.
Now you're thinking like a sysadmin.
Yeah, it's hacked.
That's nice. That's very nice. Well, stay tuned for the upcoming story on web apps, and we're going to take a break here for just a minute.
We'll be right back.
To take a few minutes to discuss what we think the future holds for what we've come to know as web apps. There's several reasons we thought this was a timely topic. The main reason, I think, is the release of the iPhone has created a new platform for applications. It's all they're allowing people to use to expand it with. So it's really, I think, caused people to be a little more aware of how to create a nice web app and make that usable, more like an application than it is just like a static web page.
Right.
So what are some of the advantages of web apps? Well, you can use it and have it be a centralized location for all of your information. An example is Gmail. Before webmail came around, you pretty much had either an application on your desktop, or you had to do an IMAP service, or you could terminal in to do your email. But a webmail service lets you have a desktop-like experience on a web page reading your email so that you don't feel like you need to use a POP3 account or an IMAP account to download your email to Outlook or Thunderbird or one of the many other web or the other desktop applications out there. And this is spread to other things. A big one that I use all the time is Google Reader. Mm-hmm. And I like to have that because then no matter where I am, if I want to read some news real quick, boom, there it is, centralized. I don't have to worry about using a desktop app, which is how I started doing News Reader activities. So it's pretty easy to see the benefits of a web apps.
Right.
But then there's some negatives. And the big one is you have to be online to use it. Mm-hmm. And this is what people, companies like Google and other big companies like Adobe with their Flash Player, they're trying to figure out how can we leverage these online, you know, easy to deploy applications for people who are no longer connected to the internet. Now that's going to become less and less important, I think, over time. Yet it's always going to be an issue. I don't really see us, at least not over the next 5 years, ever being in a place where there's always going to be somewhere where we go where we won't have internet access.
Right.
At least for a while. So, you know, what are a few web apps that you use, Ryan?
Number one's got to be Gmail.
Mm-hmm.
We just talked about Google Maps.
Right. Google Maps is a big one.
I'm trying to think about non-Google web apps that I use. I don't know.
Yeah. Google is a big one. And I mean, that's because that's what they've built their business on.
Mm-hmm.
Google Maps, I think, is actually a really important one. If you think back to what was the one before Google Maps that I used all the time? I can't even remember the name of it now.
We're talking MapQuest?
MapQuest. That was the big one.
Yeah.
Before that, I mean, I would spend the money on the Microsoft product or what is it? Delorme, I think it was. Streets mm-hmm. and Trips or something.
I guess you could say that WordPress and stuff like that is sort of...
Yeah, actually, that's a big one we missed. Is just a blog in general is an online
word editor.
You know, online word editor and online you know, publisher for your website, which mm-hmm. is... That changed the way things were because then you can go to somebody's house if you think you want to type a post real quick. Boom, mm-hmm. there you go. You don't have to publish an HTML file.
Maybe Flash Games?
Flash Games are a big web app, definitely. And then, you know, any of the Writely, which now is a Google product, Google Docs, but they were the first really online word processor.
SketchUp, which now also acquired by Google.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a ton, I mean, pretty much anything you want to do, there's a web app for it. There's online photo editing, online, even online video editing now, which is just crazy.
That is crazy.
So we've talked a little bit about the negatives, and really the big negative that people are trying to overhaul is the being offline part. And a lot of companies are trying to push ahead in that realm. We talked several episodes back about Adobe's Flex product. What's important about that one, excuse me, is that it allows you to deploy the same exact application to client-side, web-side, and various things, but it still kind of separates those into their individual resources. Google has released a product recently called Google Gears, which I don't believe we've covered on the show yet.
I don't think so.
Basically, what that does is it only works right now for Google Reader. Now, what you do is you have to click Go Offline, and then it parses all of your news feeds into a database file, basically, and lets you then go through, read your news, you know, mark it as a favorite, whatever you want to do. And then you can go online, and it syncs it back up with your online Google database, Google Reader database.
Nice.
There's some flaws with that, though. You have to click the button. So if, say, I'm going to the airport, close my notebook, think I'm going to have a second, I'm running late through security, don't have time to open up my notebook, go offline, then I'm on the plane, can't read my news. That to me is a big flaw in the Google Gears product. They need to find a way to have it do that all the time without slowing down my internet access.
Right. So in other words, like if I'm idle and I walk past a coffee shop and there's an open Wi-Fi point there, connect, sync me,
mm-hmm.
and then don't even ask me about it.
Right.
You know.
Well, and I mean, what I'd ideally like to do is not have to even think about it. I don't want to have to click sync.
Yeah.
I want it to just be synced.
To do it.
I want it to be like my any other desktop app where it's just there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when I open it up, I can use it. Right now, if you're not synced up, you're just not going to be able to get to it.
Right.
So that's kind of a problem, but I'm sure they'll overcome that. I'd love to see this resource be tied into like a thing like the iPhone, though.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine where you could do that with the iPhone or some other handheld device. I don't care who makes it, you know, Nokia. They need to be leveraging this kind of thing, too.
Because it's going to have a connection most of the time. Yeah.
Right. But then, you know, if you go on an airplane, I mean, that's the perfect thing to use the sync type mentality, because you're going to have some sort of access point when it's on. So right before you get on the plane, you sync. It's perfect for that.
Mm.
But the desktop, I think, needs some sort of way to automatically sync all the time. But then there's a problem there, because if you have 7 or 8 web apps you use a lot and they're all syncing, you're not going to have any bandwidth left, because they're all going to be syncing. So
right.
It's a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, I hear you. I think this is important, too, as we kind of... We're coming into this time of... I guess this is always happening. You kind of have simultaneous conversion and, you know, diversion. So we have pretty much the operating system wars are pretty much over. You know, we have app, we have, you know, the Mac OS stuff, and then we have Windows, and there's Linux. So we have three players. PCs are pretty much generic, and I mean, PC is a PC wherever you go. But we're also starting to kind of have more diversification as far as the, I guess, the form factor for hardware that we do things on. So we have our PCs, we have our laptops, we have our smartphones now, like iPhone, and we're now having things like Xbox 360 or Wii, which are, if not web browser, you know, capable. I mean, they are capable, but maybe it's just not there yet.
Right.
You know, I guess what we runs what, Opera?
Yeah, Wii has a version of Opera.
Right.
360 has nothing.
360 has nothing currently, but they could easily just give us something if they wanted to. And then we have things like Apple TV. We got some middle, sort of middle range, sort of pseudo computer type things there. So any of these things could easily run a browser.
Exactly.
So I think with that becoming the norm of a browser running on my phone, my iPod, my gaming box, my television, my computer, that all of these things will be more important. And one of the reasons that the web apps are awesome for that is they don't care what's on the other end. All the power and all the guts are on the server side.
Right.
So who cares how much RAM you have? You know, who cares what operating system you have? As long as you can run that browser, you're good.
But the more powerful a web app gets, the less it is that case. I mean, if you think about, you know, the history of, you know, rolling back a little bit, the history of computing, it started out with the terminal mainframe mentality.
Right.
And then we moved, you know, to client server, where the clients have a lot more power. They're doing some more of the number crunching, but your data is still stored on a network. Then with the beginning of web apps, they really were back to that terminal mainframe mentality, where it's all you're really seeing is an image displaying, and all your information is located on a server somewhere.
Right.
But with the newer apps, they're doing a lot more of the crunching on the device. For example, the Google Gears thing. I mean, it is actually, once you go offline, it's all on your machine. So you still do need something a little more powerful. And I wonder if the browser is going to be able to keep up with these new apps. So, I mean, web app kind of makes it automatically have to be in a browser, but that's kind of where Adobe Flex comes in, where it's using Flash, which is really a separate application running in your browser. So that's why the Flash applications can look wowie-zowie. They can look more like a desktop app. So I'm not sure what the future holds, but in my mind, I see the browser eventually going away. And we have that's not entirely true. But I see more functionality coming from apps that parse your information from the web and sync with the web, but they are specialized apps still that run on your desktop separate from your browser. Good example would be this application we're going to be demoing later, maybe a few weeks from now, called Sketch, where it's actually an image manipulation tool that then syncs with your online account, so all your images that you edit are then stored on the web, so you can access them anywhere.
Yeah,
things like that I really think are maybe the future.
And this was kind
of web.
Yeah, this was one of the things that Steve Jobs mentioned at the All Things Digital interview, and then he was saying, you know, the direction that he wants to take iPhone and a lot of things was just to be able to pull services from like the internet cloud,
right,
and then package it within the Apple interface and then show it to you.
Yeah.
So,
and that's why I think you'll always still need that specialized you know, desktop version of the web app. Mm-hmm. I really don't see us. I used to think that all I need is a web browser, and that's kind of, you know, when we started tossing around this idea, that's kind of where I was. But the more I look into it, you know, the things like the YouTube app on Apple TV takes a great web app mm-hmm. and turns it into a great desktop app that pulls from the web.
Right.
And Flickr is another example. For me, it's kind of the flip side of that, though. Flickr is a great, you know, storage place for all my photos, and I can tag them and everything. Getting them to that, I still need a good web app, or I can send an email to it. So it's like, it's the convergence of the web and the desktop, and we're gonna, that's really starting to happen more and more, and that's what I'm excited about, is, you know, more use of, there's no difference between when you're online and when you're offline.
Right. I was just about to say that, because I think, I mean, they're already working on ways for passenger aircraft to always be on the internet
mm-hmm.
because it's going to jump through these special cell towers.
Right.
And I think, you know, Wi-Fi's are going to become more ubiquitous as the municipal cities, just as all the city mm-hmm. services roll out their Wi-Fi stuff, and pretty much there will be no offline.
Right.
Unless you're like moose hunting in Alaska, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
You're going to have to work at it to be out of the internet cloud.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe one day this won't be an issue at all.
And it would be, part of me still kind of hopes that the browser will be the final say, because then the OS no longer is relevant.
Right.
Because then you're not developing for, you know, a desktop app, but that's kind of what Java was all about. And,
right.
And it, I think the reason that won't happen is because it's still just a little bit slower.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have someone giving you the exact same service and one's faster, you're going to go with the faster one every time.
But you know what's weird about that too, is that if the browser really is the future battleground for all of the application
mm-hmm.
stuff, odd that that's, will it stay free? You know what I mean? I mean, right now mm-hmm. Firefox is free, IE, I guess free,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's kind of weird that,
yeah.
you know, with the browser being so dependent, and I guess we're really going to have to rely on standards
right?
To keep us alive with the web app mm-hmm. stuff.
And I think that's probably, that's another point to that the browser won't be the main interface, because people are going to want to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And you make money by having a specialized app that you have to pay for.
Right.
So while there are exceptions to that, Google is making lots of money without selling you an application. In general, I don't see that as the future for every company.
Mm-hmm.
That I just don't see that working for everybody. Because not everybody's going to have a stranglehold on the ad industry online.
Well, hopefully what it'll be, too, is that you'll have basic services which remain free. But
right.
then if you want, you know, the icing on the cake,
yeah, that's
you
true.
Know. So, like, in other words, if you want, you know, directions to the nearest, you know, Italian restaurant, mm-hmm. you can get that for free. But if you want turn-by-turn directions,
mm-hmm.
you know, in real time with a GPS, then that's going to be $10 a month.
Right.
And, you know, there's a good chance people will fork that over.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting. I'll be curious how things pan out. Right now, I'm putting my money on free on the web, specialized desktop apps that cost money, but are taking more advantage of the web interface, and there's a seamless transition between your faster desktop app and your app on the web.
In the toolbox this week, we're talking FTP, that's File Transfer Protocol. Chances are you've used it, chances are you've hated it if you didn't like your client. But no matter what you do, you probably still need to do this every once in a while. For me, I probably wound up using it mostly to sync websites or push mm-hmm. content to web servers, this and that. Every once in a while, I actually use it what it was originally intended for, which is to put files somewhere for someone else to get.
Right.
Or to trade files. So with that in mind, I put together a quick roundup for just a few minutes of some of the more popular FTP clients. I tried to keep them free. I tried to keep them no spam and kind of go across the board with maybe different levels of people that will want to use it.
Mm.
So to get started, let's talk about The first one, which is from WhisperTech, and it's called FTP Surfer. So FTP Surfer is cool because really what you get is just a window. It's a window, and then on the right side, you see files, and on the left side, you see folders. And what you can do is on the left side, you can just add websites. So you can so like say for my website, I have its name on the left, and I click the little plus next to its name, and suddenly it just logs in because you put in your password and your username, and all of the files just appear on the right.
Nice.
Now, the power of this really is getting files to and from it. Because now, in Windows, I can just drag a file and drop it on the window, bam, it uploads. Mm-hmm. I can grab any file in the window inside FTP Surfer and pull it out to the desktop and let it go, and it downloads it.
Nice.
So this is a great client for people that want something free, quick, no drama, people that don't want to understand FTP, you know, at that level. They just need to move some files quick, and they want, you know, just a thing that just automatically connects with no drama, whatever.
Nice.
Now, it doesn't have some of the deeper features like some of the other clients that we're going to cover, but it is free, whispertech.com. The next one is one of the classics, which is WSFTP. And this is one of the ones pretty much you see, you know, a lot. I mean, they've been around a long time. This is the one from the IP switch guys. Now, this one is not as beautiful of an interface. When you come up, it has sort of the, I'd call it sort of the navigator interface, where you have the local stuff on the left, the remote stuff on the right. Mm-hmm. You click a file on the left, highlight it, hit the little arrow, and it loads it and it pushes it, and then it appears on the right. And it's the same for downloads.
Right.
Now, it does offer some more expanded features for more power users. It does support right-click. So you can right-click files on the remote side and change permissions, like Unix permissions.
That's nice.
You can do the change mod and all that kind of stuff. You can delete files. One thing that it does suffer from, though, is very difficult, at least in the previous versions, to delete nested directories.
Mm-hmm.
Because generally, it doesn't want to let you delete directories that have stuff in them.
Right.
It wants you to clean that content out. And then if you've ever had to do that, then it was just so painful. But anyway, the WSFTP from IP switch is one of the classic ones, one of the ones that I still use. Moving on from there, our last Windows FTP client is one for folks that need something a little more secure.
Mm-hmm.
And it is WinSCP for secure copy. And that's at winscp.net. And this one is good because if you're in a situation like, say, at work, and they offer you maybe the ability to upload files, but only with secure FTP. So this one, you can set it up to do tunneling, port 22, I mean, anything like that. And you can also let it do like an old rollback to the regular FTP if, if you try to connect to something that doesn't. Right. If it doesn't support it, it'll roll back and try the regular FTP. But this is one we use, you know, when we don't have access to the regular port 21 FTP type stuff. It does work very well. It has some of the expanded features for permissions and keeping track of things. Pretty much all of these will generate log files, you know, so if you need to troubleshoot, like, you know, how come I can't connect? And you look at the log and you see that your password's bad or your startup directory is incorrect or something like that. But WinSCP is really good if you have some secure stuff that you need to do. Finally, we'll talk about CyberDuck. And this is for the Mac users out there.
What up?
Yay. So CyberDuck is a free app for the Apple computer users out there. And I don't know, it's a little rubber ducky icon. What can I tell you?
It's awesome.
It does work pretty well. It has a nice interface. It lets you, they kind of call it bookmarks.
Mm-hmm.
So you create a list of FTP sites, and you hit a little button, and a little thing slides out. Of course, everything on the Mac has to be beautiful, man.
That's right.
So it slides out, and then you can pick your website, hit it, it connects. And then it's kind of like FTP Surfer in that you just drag files in and let go, and it uploads it, or you can pull files out. So it's really easy to use. It works pretty well. They do update it very regularly. It seems like every
almost
week.
Almost too often, actually. Yeah. It's kind of annoying.
So every time I fire it up, it's like, you're behind. It's like, great, thanks for nothing.
Well, and it's one of those annoying ones where it doesn't really let you, I mean, it just keeps nagging you every time you open it. You can't just ignore it.
Right, right. But it does work really well.
Yeah.
It's what I use to upload our podcast every week. So, and I do have a significant amount of time on each of these clients. We wouldn't recommend something that we don't use.
Yeah.
But we'll have links to each of these four FTP clients in the show notes in case you want to try any of them out.
Well, that is going to wrap up one more episode of the Angry Admin Podcast. Thank you for listening. We appreciate all of the tens of dozens of listeners that we have.
We love you guys.
But yeah, again, you know, we do have that website out there waiting for you guys to go look at it. We appreciate those of you who have participated, and the forum that we have there is readily used by myself and Ryan.
We do read it.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so go check out the website, angryadmins.com. If you have any topic stories or any rants about any tech-related topics for us, send those to feedback@angryadmins.com. We appreciate any information there. So until next time, I am Joe Bibby.
And I'm Ryan Necessary.
Stay angry.